Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and it's great to have everybody on the show. And by everybody, I mean we've got an action-packed, fun-filled, high-quality group of guests on tonight. I can't wait to have the show get off the ground, but of course, we can't even begin to think about getting off the ground until my co-pilot, Sam, is here. Hey, Sam.
Hey there. I apologize ahead of time for any barking dogs in the background, but it's been a pretty interesting week here, Jamie. In fact, I had to text you to see if you weren't underwater back in the Maryland area, but then I remembered you're on a hill, so you're smarter than a lot of people. Wow. So we're going to talk about that. In fact, our weather guy, we're going to call Alberto, but it's actually Kyle Nelson, is going to tell us all about what's going on in the weather.
Well, hey, Sam, good evening to you and everyone on the Disaster Podcast. Quick recap on the weather roundup. It's been a busy week in weather. I mean, everything from a tornado at 8,000 feet above sea level in Wyoming to multiple tornadoes out on the eastern central parts of Colorado at one time, all the way to record May heat in the Midwest, which set new record Memorial Day high temperatures, to flooding and things in North Carolina. But to subtropical, Storm Alberto, which apparently is my nickname here. But anyways, it's made landfall Monday, yesterday, the 28th of May in Laguna Beach, Florida. Maximum sustained winds around 40 miles an hour, so nothing too big there. But, of course, with any landfalling tropical system or subtropical, storm surge and high winds are probably the two biggest threats, and, of course, heavy rainfall there as well. Just to clarify the whole subtropical versus tropical game, subtropical, it's basically only a thing us meteorologist types really focus on. Its biggest thing is this storm drew its energy both from differences in air temperatures between kind of polar and tropical air masses, as well as from the ocean water, where your traditional tropical systems draw their energy specifically from the very warm ocean water, in this case, in the Gulf. So, little definition for you, but impacts still being felt far and wide with high winds and heavy rains from central Tennessee, Kentucky, all the way through the North Carolinas and the Virginias as well over the next week. So very, very active weather in store. And just kind of kick things off here, I'll toss it to Jamie now, talking just a little bit about the very damaging and destructive flooding that has occurred now for the second time just in 2 years in Ellicott City, Maryland.
Yeah, and Ellicott City is a pretty, it's pretty prone to flooding in general. The Patapsco River runs right through the center of the town or right near the town, and the town itself sits down between two hills that go down into the center of the valley there, and it's pretty narrow area between those two hills that the town's kind of built into this hillside and stuff. So imagine that kind of feature and getting 8 inches of rain in the space of a couple of hours. And all that rain just funneled right down into the river. The river flooded and then hit the town. And you had flooding that was at record levels. And they had a record flood 2 years ago. And I'll bring this up, Kyle, because we talked a little bit about it last week in the episode about classifications of different weather events and how people really don't understand, or we don't do a good job of explaining what they mean to them. A lot of people here in the Baltimore area are saying, how can we have 2,000-year storms in the space of 2 or 3 years?
Well, Jamie, that's another way that us weather types classify things. So what Jamie is referring to is two 1,000-year events in very short proximity to each other. That is, based on the depth of rain that fell, the time over which it fell, and how often it typically occurs, it's about 1 in 1,000 years for that event to occur in that particular location in Maryland. And this is how we classify it on the weather side, but from a community preparedness and resiliency side of things, it's important to understand that it's not that one in 1,000 year events occur only every 1,000 years. It's that they have a 0.1% chance of occurring in any given year. That, and this is a horrific yet very pertinent example of where we can have back-to-back 1,000-year flood events occurring just 2 years apart from each other. So our thoughts go out to those folks in that area.
Definitely. Wow. And Joe, you had a comment maybe?
Oh, no, I didn't. I wanted to say hello to everybody, and I was thinking about the 1,000-year event as well, and clearly if you watched any of the TV footage of some of that flooding going on, I could see why that would be considered a 1,000-year event. That was insane in its intensity.
You know, the first time I remember flooding there was Hurricane Agnes, which takes it way back, I think, the early 70s. And my dad, I grew up about a half hour from there, and my dad took me down to sit to the hill above the city, above the town. And I just looked down and saw these buildings with water up to the first floor, you know, up above, to the top of the first floor, beginning of the second floor. And, you know, that flooding had happened due to a tropical system that had a prolonged exposure in the area. This was, you know, more of a quick event, and actually also ended quickly, whereas the Agnes event, you know, the flooding was prolonged. So it's interesting to see how different systems have affected this area over time and over the years. And I think, you know, it'll flood again because of just the topographical features of the area. So it's a shame to, you know, expect that. Hopefully nothing as severe as this, but it's something that community kind of understands, at least to some extent, they're going to get some limited flooding at least.
Well, Kyle mentioned both Tennessee and North Carolina, and since we have representatives from both, how have you been affected by all this, Joe, Tennessee?
Well, I've been actually pretty lucky. We have had minimal rain and that sort of stuff. I think we're going to get a little bit of the edges of the main brunt of the storm over the next 24 hours or so. So hopefully it won't be anything too significant. And we certainly haven't gotten the rain that elsewhere has had.
We also have our friend, Dr. Seth Hawkins, who is in North Carolina. And I guess you're getting wet up there, aren't you, Seth?
Hold on. Let me put down my canoe paddle here and talk with y'all. Yeah, I didn't know electronics could be held above water and work. So, yeah, no, we're doing great here at in North Carolina, not to be flippant about a pretty serious situation. So there is some pretty big flooding here. We had two deaths, tragically, of news personnel covering the storms. And, yeah, it's been pretty torrential.
Oh, my. Well, not to do another weather episode, which we've done the last three, it's easy to do. But you're back with us because we have another one of your authors from your wonderful Wilderness EMS book, and that would be Chris Davis. And we're going to talk about something that I don't think has been talked about a whole lot, and that is infectious disease management in a wilderness setting. So, Seth, you want to Chris could say hi to everybody, but would you like to introduce him?
Yeah, I'm really excited about this one. This is going to be a great episode, and having Dr. Chris Davis on is really getting some real expertise for us about infectious diseases. He wrote Chapter 20 in the Wilderness EMS text, which discussed general infectious diseases in the wilderness environment. So, Dr. Davis, we're really excited to have you here with us.
Excellent. It's great to be here.
And please tell us about your background.
Yes, please do.
Well, first of all, I'm a North Carolina native, so I definitely can appreciate how rare this kind of rain and flooding has been. I've never seen anything quite like it here. But I'm an emergency physician here at Wake Forest University in Winston-Salem, and I'm currently a Wilderness EMS Fellow here in the Department of Emergency Medicine. It's really the first of its kind. It's a combination of a traditional EMS fellowship where you learn medical direction of your typical front country EMS systems sort of combined with a wilderness medicine fellowship, which has traditionally been sort of seen as ad hoc medical care on expeditions or in the backcountry. And what we're doing is we're creating kind of a longitudinal experience that trains physicians to lead EMS systems in wilderness areas. I've also done some other things in the past as well. Used to be a charter sailing captain, so that could come in handy if the weather keeps up like it does. Also work on a mountain rescue team, the Appalachian Mountain Rescue Team here, and formerly owner of a wilderness medicine school here in North Carolina.
Well, you're as busy as Seth with 100 different projects going. That guy, I don't know how you keep up with yourself, Seth. But this is Dr. Davis' first podcast, and we're glad to have him on. So let's jump into our subject. And, you know, when you're thinking about wilderness, you're thinking about outside and fresh air and all of that, and you don't really think about infectious disease. Are wilderness responders any safer out there than the people that work in an urban environment?
You know, it's really interesting. When started conceiving of this chapter, it's true. This is not stuff that we're usually thinking about in the wilderness, but it's definitely something that is prevalent. And when we look at the sort of the statistics and the data from the how common this stuff is, one of the best things to look to, what I found, was the data that collected by the National Park Service on EMS calls to national parks. And you know, traumatic injuries are definitely leading the charge for like most common common EMS call in the national parks. But you know, still a little less than half of are sort of the wastebasket of other medical calls. And you know, certainly a considerable number of those can be related to infectious diseases. If you look at our typical front country EMS or traditional EMS, you know, people with pneumonia, infections, sepsis, all of that stuff definitely makes up a large percentage of our calls. We definitely see in the wilderness that our user group is typically more fit. If you already had a fever and felt terrible, you're probably not likely to set off on a 10-day backpacking trip into a wilderness area. But, you know, some due to incubation periods and things like that, definitely any infectious disease that you could see in the front country, you definitely could encounter in the backcountry. Certainly our, you know, as some of our wilderness areas become more accessible, people feel better about going to them, you know, either rightly or wrongly because of increased access to technology and cell phones and things. I think we're definitely seeing people with more medical comorbidities and other things going into the wilderness. And, you know, Seth and I both have definitely seen everything from, you know, chest pain to myocardial infarctions or heart attacks, asthma exacerbations, all of these things in wilderness EMS calls that, you know, we typically, you know, don't think of as something we would need to definitively manage. But because of the long extrication times and sort of prolonged care situation, we have to consider actually treating infectious diseases in the wilderness. And not just the typical stuff you think of, like I got a tick-borne illness or I got something from a mosquito. It could be anything from a urinary tract infection to pneumonia.
Well, one thing you're making me reflect on that Kyle can relate to is diabetics that are out, that are generally, now you're right when you say people out hiking in the backcountry are obviously more fit, but we get people up on ski patrol, not so much. They're not eating right, they're drinking alcohol, they're at altitude, so, you know, they don't think about how that may exacerbate their diabetes. It's just one example. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely. It's definitely something, you know, we're seeing both with the accessibility of the wilderness areas and, you know, people that may have not felt comfortable going into the wilderness, you know, 20 years ago, now they've got a cell phone, may think, you know, I can, it doesn't seem that far. I can get back there and rightly or wrongly, you know, we're definitely seeing that more often, you know, ski patrol and you know, mountain rescue, all that.
Well, unfortunately their cell phone does more fit. Any thoughts on that, Seth?
Yeah, I think the other interesting angle to all this, in addition to the increasing technology that the users bring to the table, is what the responders have. And one of the things that Dr. Davis and I wrestled with in the chapter was this new concept that maybe we needed to be managing infections more aggressively in the wilderness. So there's a lot of dialogue now in mainstream traditional front country medical care and hospital-based medical care on managing sepsis and on very aggressive treatment of life-threatening infections. And one of the questions we had was, how does that work in the wilderness? So, you know, hikers and paddlers have mobile phones and satellite phones and GPS systems and all sorts of technology. Should they be expecting similarly complex and sophisticated responses from the rescuers who come to get them? So I thought that was one of the more interesting parts of this challenge, which really is different from other wilderness medicine textbooks that don't, you know, they may mention an antibiotic to carry, or they may mention some things, but not necessarily like the aggressive treatment of a infectious disease by healthcare providers.
Oh, absolutely. Plus, you know, there's the issue of you can't carry a whole ton of equipment. You have to carry specialized things and you know, light. But I know we're mostly going to talk about what to do about some of these things. But, Chris, can you talk a little bit about some of the kind of infectious diseases that you might find in the wilderness, what the typical calls may be?
Absolutely. Some of the stuff that you look at is that's going to be most common, I kind of like to think about in two categories, is either things that we're going to be called to go rescue a patient for, you know, if they're sick with some sort of infection, or consequently, infections that may be encountered by the rescuers themselves. That so we, in a prolonged mission, definitely we ourselves as rescuers can be just as susceptible to a lot of these infectious diseases that that the patients were. So interestingly too, you know, think that sometimes if you're going deep into a wilderness area, you know, those of us that are would-be rescuers, we were on our couches right before this started, not preparing to necessarily be inserted into the wilderness for a long period of time. And so, you know, if you're not feeling tip top, you know, you still might end up out there, and then a couple days later, you're feeling pretty bad. So some of the stuff that we'll typically see, I mean, everything from pneumonia, urinary tract infections, cellulitis or skin and soft tissue infections are probably the most common, I would say. But really, it can run the gamut. But I would definitely say, first and foremost, I've had the most experience with skin and soft tissue infections in the wilderness, simply because, you know, we're out playing, having a good time, doing things with knives, sharp sticks, rocks, climbing around, and it's dirty out there. So you can definitely have a great opportunity to invite lots of little bugs into your cuts and scrapes and end up with an infection there.
Yeah, tetanus shots are a wonderful thing. Any thoughts, Joe, on this so far?
Oh, lots and lots. You know, I mean, I think if you look at this sort of from my particular perspective as a USAR guy, you know, we see various and sundry skin and respiratory syndromes after prolonged exposure to water and being in the field for a number of days, and you know, not enough sleep, and a state in the different part of the country that I'm used to being in. And I think part of the real challenge is sort of sorting out how much of that is allergic or inflammatory versus infectious. And I don't know, I'd appreciate the group's input on maybe tips and tricks to help folks kind of separate those two groups out.
Absolutely.
Go ahead.
Oh no, I was just going to say that's a great place to start with that. I mean, if you're looking at particularly pulmonary infections, that's definitely one where there's a ton of overlap between sort of either chemical or particulate irritants, allergic responses, and infections are all you know, definitely can produce very similar syndromes. And Seth, do you have anything to add on this particular? This is definitely something worth diving into, I think.
Yeah, for sure. There's a lot of overlap, and the things that I think are, you know, in medicine, we call it pathognomonic, or things that uniquely attribute to one versus the other, in my opinion, would particularly be fever. So in those cases where somebody is spiking a temperature over 100.3 degrees Fahrenheit or 38 degrees Celsius, is pretty certain that you're more likely dealing with an infection. And then I think the other thing we look to in medicine is just eliminating factors that could explain something away. So, for instance, if you're on a trip of a lifetime on the Colorado River, and somebody starts peeing and it hurts, and it's a burning kind of sensation, but they don't have any kind of trauma, or they have no cut around the genitals or anything like that. Those are the sort of things I think that really start to point towards infectious sources. So, two things I would say would be fever and nothing that really explains away what they're feeling.
Well, you know, another thought on this, and thinking in terms of what you guys find in the wilderness versus what Joe may get in the ER after the fact, some of these things don't really show up right away, do they? I'm thinking tick-borne and some of the things you mentioned. Chris?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, some of these sort of either vector-borne illnesses or sort of classic wilderness-associated infections won't necessarily be evident at all while you're still in the wilderness. One of the, one of the classic ones is something that we kind of haven't touched on yet, but is a very prominent source of infection is gastrointestinal illnesses. I'm sure kind of everybody would be nodding their heads right there and think they either go on a camping trip with some people, get diarrhea or something like that. That's really common. And so a lot of the typical like protozoal infections and things that we think about as associated with the wilderness won't necessarily show up until you're already back at home. And you know, the same thing goes for, you know, if you're getting odd pulmonary infections from exposure to bat guana and things like that, then you're definitely, those things you would look to probably be coming on, you know, days to even weeks later, not so much for the pulmonary things, but you will definitely see that. So if you have to look, you know, if you're trying to suss out, is this a allergic, pulmonary issue? Is this a chemical irritant and things? It's more just, you know, I definitely agree with Seth that a high fever is a huge indicator that you've got an infection. But, you know, other things like a cough or, you know, sputum production, things may not be as helpful. But when you put all the pictures together, I mean, was this guy just working in a really moldy environment and got the symptoms pretty quickly thereafter? You know, it's less likely to be a pneumonia if you're looking at it that way.
Oops, trying to unmute myself here. So, Joe, thinking about it in terms of that, if you have a patient in with some signs and symptoms that aren't making a whole lot of sense, but find out they have been backpacking and they have been in the wilderness, does that change your whole mindset as in terms of, what you're looking at?
Well, I think it certainly broadens your differential diagnosis. You know, you have to suddenly start considering a whole lot of illnesses that you might not have given much thought to earlier. So, you know, delving into sort of where they've been, what kind of exposures they might have had, you know, as we were just talking about, certainly it's easy to ingest a significant amount of germs of out in the field when you don't intend to. So, you know, you can't assume things like clean drinking water and other things that you don't think too much about in a patient who's not had exposure to an austere environment.
Jamie, any thoughts from you?
Well, I'm just thinking, you know, one of the most interesting experiences of my youth was on a canoe trip down the Shenandoah River in West Virginia and into Western Virginia. And we were 12, 13, 14 year olds, a group of about six of us, plus a camp counselor and a junior counselor. The counselor was a college student. The junior counselor was a kid who'd been on the trip the year before. On the third day of a 4-day trip, our counselor became delirious with a severe stomach infection of some sort, violent throwing up and diarrhea, with a bunch of kids who really had no idea what we were supposed to do. We were in a relatively remote area where we didn't really readily see any homes along the side of the river, although we found out later they were there if we just walked, walked up the hill, essentially. So we basically had to take our counselor down the river until we got to a place where we could see a house. And it took us about half a day to get to the point where we were comfortable stopping and going and seeking help. But, you know, it had an impact on me of how helpless we felt. And I think that it's important, I think, for the responder to try to get a handle on that and I guess deal with the psychological effects of a severe infection on both the individual who's infected and the other people in the group.
Wow, I'm surprised they didn't have more than one adult there.
They changed that policy the next year.
sounds like a good reason for a new policy.
Yeah, I'm thinking, well, maybe that's what drove you into medicine. Who knows? Because you had that feeling of helplessness. You never know. Kyle, any thoughts from you?
No, Sam, kind of the same for me. Similar to Jamie, backpacking trip in the Great Smoky Mountains, had a similar experience to Jamie. And not surprisingly, a policy change very shortly afterwards.
It's too bad it takes something like that. Can we talk a bit about specifically pulmonary infections? What and why and what do you do about it, Chris?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so pulmonary infections really run the gamut. So if you have to think of them like almost all infections are really exist on a spectrum, right? I mean, you can get everything from what we consider one of the most minor, trivial pulmonary infections would be something like bronchitis. And what that is an inflammation or infection of the larger airways, the bronchioles. And that's usually going to be something that is, have a cough. We'd hear wheezing if we listen to their chest. And these people are typically not going to have a fever. They're not going to have really difficulty breathing. They may feel a little out of breath, but they're not going to have any true respiratory distress. And these things we're going to manage typically with what we call supportive care or medicines that just make people feel better and alleviate their symptoms a little bit. These are not going to be our life-threatening emergencies or anything. But then when we kind of progress down and infection becomes a little more severe, you have pneumonia. And pneumonia is something we've all heard of and we've all, may have even had. But what that really is going on, if you really break it down, is an infection of the parenchyma or what we call the sort of the functional tissue of the lung. So this is the infection has gone from just being some minor inflammation of the large airways all the way down in the lung itself. The bacteria are the one most feared causative agents. You'll get, they'll set up shop and they'll multiply, replicate. Our blood cells, white blood cells will move in, try to kill them, and we'll get lots of fluid build up in our lungs. Typically these patients are going to have a fever. Like Seth mentioned, we're looking at over 100.3, but often they can have a much higher fever up to 102, 103 degrees. And these patients will usually have some visibly difficult time breathing. If you're taking their vital signs, these people will typically have, like I said, a fever, tachycardia, which is a fast heart rate, greater than 100, and they'll have also fast breathing rate. So, typically you're looking at 20, 30 times a minute. For, some basic diagnostic stuff that's very easy to employ in a disaster or wilderness area, pulse oximetry can be an excellent device to use in your sort of diagnosis and management. It's basically a very simple little device that you can even just get on Amazon for, 10 or 20 bucks or at the drugstore, that measures your body's blood concentration of oxygen. And this can really tell you that there's a process going on in the lung itself that's impairing the body's ability to exchange oxygen into our red blood cells in the lungs, which that's, again, one of those really good clues that this may be maybe a pneumonia, not something else that's sort of more minor like a bronchitis. And by that point, when people have fever, trouble breathing, they have low oxygen levels, this is getting to be like a pretty big emergency for folks, and need to have access to antibiotics and supplemental oxygen and things like that are becoming pretty important at that point. So really trying to recognize these things, and, you know, bronchitis or other things like that don't necessarily progress to pneumonia, and they're not necessarily associated either, but they have a lot of overlapping symptoms like cough and shortness of breath and some wheezing and things. But really, to differentiate between the two, you know, you're looking for the patient that has a fever, that is got a fast heart rate, that's breathing quickly and may have low oxygen saturations, or that number that should be between, you know, 94 to 100 is somewhere down, you know, 91, 92, or even maybe in the 80s would be something we would see there. And these patients need antibiotics. That's really the big difference there. They need antibiotics, whereas antibiotics are not necessarily helpful for bronchitis. You know, because these are typically caused by viral processes, and, you know, viruses, you know, are not killed by antibiotics. It's antibiotics only kill the bacteria. So, you know, if you've got a bacterial pneumonia and got a high fever, having trouble breathing, all that stuff, these people need antibiotics. So this is something that, you know, you go to your doctor, something may not be a huge deal if you're somewhere in the front country, but if we're in the wilderness, you know, we don't typically have access to antibiotics with traditional EMS systems. This is something where we thought, you know, could be a beneficial role for real wilderness EMS systems.
Well, I want to throw this to Seth in just a second, but is there anything in the wilderness that predispose them to a pulmonary infection that would be more likely there in the front country?
So not specifically. I mean, there are certain pulmonary infections that you may see that if you're in certain regions that caused by things other than bacteria that we would see, you know, for example, there's different fungus like coccidiomycosis or histoplasmosis, some odd things if you're in certain parts of the country like the Ohio River Valley or in the desert Southwest that you may have that you may be more predisposed to getting. But again, these things usually have a pretty slow onset, and you would unlikely see this as an acute fulminant infection or like a really bad febrile pneumonia that you would just kind of overtake you while still in the wilderness on the same trip.
Seth, your thoughts?
Yeah, I have a bunch of comments on all this, and I love where this is going. Just to loop back to the really important dialogue about things that attack you in the wilderness, and then have later delayed symptoms versus managing common things in the wilderness. That's such an important distinction, and we wrestle with it so much that this is the only chapter in the book where we actually separate out the chapter into two parts. So we have one part really dealing with common infectious diseases in the wilderness, like pneumonia and urinary tract infections. And that's the chapter that that Chris Davis wrote with Howie Mill, another prominent EMS physician. And then we had actually an entirely different part of the chapter written by Frank Hubble and Lee Frizzell of SOLO, which was dealing with infectious diseases specifically contracted in the wilderness. So things like tick-borne illnesses and diarrheal illnesses and things that you might see manifest from being out in the wilderness, but your management of it is actually probably going to be in a front country hospital or clinic. So we really thought, I mean, that's such that we wrestled with that so hard that that we actually split those out into two sets. Different, obviously, managing an infection in the wilderness is completely different than managing it in the clinic. But we wanted to cover both topics. And one cranky words matter kind of topic I'd love to hit here is just the idea of fever in general, since we have this opportunity to talk about it. And I think it's something which is frequently misunderstood in common parlance. So in medicine, we would say that a fever is anything defined as 100.3 degrees Fahrenheit or 38 degrees Celsius or higher. And I think it's important to point out that the human body can have variances from the 98.6 degree Fahrenheit temperature we hear about as the equilibrium or the baseline. So a low-grade fever technically if you're really drilling down on it, is a fever over 100.3 that's kind of slightly elevated from that. But things like 99 degree temperatures are actually not technically fevers at all. They're not low grade fevers. That's just a slightly elevated temperature above the baseline. But I think this sort of distinction is important for our understanding about, you know, whether somebody has an infection or not, or what a fever is, because people often think of anything that's slightly over 98.6 degrees as a low grade fever. I think another important concept, at least in my opinion, is that people don't get to define their own thresholds of fever. So if you're on a trip and somebody's feels pretty ill, and they say, well, and you take their temperature and it's normal, but they say, well, my temperature is normally 96 degrees, so a fever for me is 98 degrees. In general, it's best to stick with actually defined thresholds and not allow people to renegotiate the physiology of the human body on the fly. So just two things I wanted to kind of throw in there as we discuss infections.
And that's going to wrap up this segment, part one of our episode on infectious disease and how to manage it in the wilderness or austere setting. And we'll be back again with part two of this episode in next week's episode, so stay tuned for that. In the meantime, I want to make sure to thank our sponsors, Paragon Medical Education Group, and just make sure you take the time to head over and check out their site and reach out to them and at least say thank you for supporting every week the Disaster Podcast. Head over to paragonmedicalgroup.com and say thank you, and check out the resources they have. I can't stress this enough. I know we talk about it every week, but they have the opportunity to do some really unique things for your system and your organization, whatever it may be and wherever it may stand in the healthcare setting for disaster management and things like that. And you just have to ask them. They have opportunities and ways to help you find funding. Things like grants and things like that are always available. And they're willing to work with you within your budgetary constraints to put together the perfect experientially related program that will help your system be better prepared when that big event happens. So please reach out to them. You can also find them on Twitter at ParagonMedEDU. And we want to thank them again for supporting the show. For Sam Bradley, Joe Holly, Seth Hawkins, Chris Davis, and Kyle Nelson, everybody that was on the show this week, I want to thank you for listening. And make sure you come back next week for part two, where we pick up the rest of this conversation. And we are going to be talking a lot about the diagnostic needs and the things that you can do to understand what's exactly going on, even if you don't have all the tools of a full clinical environment. So stay tuned for that next week. In the meantime, I'll just remind you, as always, as Sam says, that disaster medicine and wilderness medicine are not your everyday medicine.